Hi and good afternoon and welcome to Open Hour. I'm Peter Robinson, standing in this week for David Latuli, and we have a really interesting range of different things happening in the arts here in the Bay Area. Later I'll be talking to Riley Costello about a new production of The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and then some interesting music from Ryan Blovert, where we're looking at the San Francisco Wind Ensemble, including pieces from Stravinsky and other wind compositions. But first, a moment of sadness for me at least, I'd like to play a short musical tribute to Glen Campbell, who died just a couple of weeks ago. He was an all-round performer. Alice Cooper reckoned he was one of the best guitarists, and he was that interesting bridge from what I call pure country to pop over the 60 years. In the time, he won at least four Grammys. He actually played at one point with the Beach Boys, with the Wrecking Crew, and starred in a movie, True Grit, with John Wayne. But before we hear any more about him, let's hear that track which he always used at the beginning of his show, Gentle on My Mind.
It's knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk. That makes me tend to leave my sleeping bag rolled up and stashed behind your couch. And it's knowing I'm not shackled by forgotten...
Yeah, there it is, Gentle on My Mind. It's a song which takes us back to 1967. But in between, we also know him for tunes such as Rhinestone Cowboy and also Galveston. And in his own life, he had his own upsets and difficulties, challenges with both drug addiction and alcoholism from which he came. And I think in some ways, people underestimated the content of what he was talking about. And in this case, I'm thinking specifically of a song called Galveston. Galveston is that port in Texas where people would ship out to on their trip to Vietnam at the height of the war. And sometimes standing on that dock, thinking about it, being on the boat as they went out there, was that question, you know, would the soldier return? So I think in a strange way, beyond pop, there was a content and a meaning, which in his case, he definitely spoke to middle America in those 1960s and early 1970s at the height of the war in Vietnam. And I think this comes out in Galveston if we just listen briefly to some of the lyrics.
Galveston, I still hear your sea winds blowing. I still see her dark eyes glowing. She was 21 when I left Galveston. Galveston, oh Galveston.
So in his voice, there is that sense of meaning, that sense of departure, that sense of loss. And I think probably the song that we began with, the famous one, Gentle on My Mind, is the one which speaks loudest to me. And just before we hear a slightly different version, I wanted to look at some of the lyrics, because to me, the actual lyrics could read as a poem in its own right. It's knowing that your door is always open and that your path is free to walk that makes me tend to leave my sleeping bag rolled up and stash behind your couch. And it's knowing I'm not shackled by forgotten words and bonds and the ink stains that are dried upon some line. So for people who want to remember the hippie generation, the hitchhiking across America, the turning up, the being free, the whole sense that this is a new era. And then the sense of movement when he refers to the back roads of his memory. And memory, of course, was really important with the whole story of Glen Campbell, because he did die with Alzheimer's. He kept his ability to sing and, for the most part, the ability to remember lyrics. And I think this is something they discovered more and more in research in Alzheimer's, particularly in the book by Oliver Sacks, where people can use memory to stir up memory through music. And in his case, he was surrounded by his family. They kept the concert going almost till the end, and occasionally he would actually have to read a note. Now, this version we're going to complete our tribute to Glen Campbell with is accompanied by John Harwood, who was the actual composer, and we will hear some wonderful, wonderful banjo picking in this version. So it's a duet, both with Glen Campbell and the opening verse sung by the actual person who wrote the music, John Harwood.
It's knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk. That makes me tend to leave my sleeping bag rolled up and stashed behind your couch. And it's knowing I'm not shackled by forgotten words and bonds and the ink stains that have dried upon someone. That keeps you in the back roads by the rivers of my memory. It keeps you ever gentle on my mind.
It's not clinging to the rocks and ivy.
Yes, well, that is just wonderful, wonderful picking, and that is the composer of the song, Gentle on My Mind, and of course, we have been paying a tribute to the great guitarist and folk singer, and indeed, country western singer, Glen Campbell.
It's just that the world will not be cursing or forgiving when I walk along some railroad track and find that you're moving on the back roads by the rivers of my memory, and for hours you're just gentle on my mind.
Although the wheat fields and the clotheslines and the junkyards and the highways come between us, and some other woman crying to her mother cause she turned and I was gone.
Hi, good evening, good afternoon. Again, I'm Peter Robinson. You're listening to Open Air. And my guest now is the director of the musical Hunchback of Notre Dame, Riley Costello. And this is opening here in the Bay Area. Riley, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about the background to the play. Everyone is probably familiar at some point with Victor Hugo and The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Let's talk about the musical, and let's talk about the changes that happen essentially in the story, the difference between a musical and the actual 19th century novel.
Great, yeah. So as you said, it's based on the classic Victor Hugo novel, which was then later adapted into the Disney animated film. This is sort of a hybrid of the two. Maybe my assumption is, or my measurement, I should say, is 60% Victor Hugo novel, 40% Disney movie. So the storyline follows a little more closely to the source material, and it has all the music that you know from the Disney film as well.
Okay. Now, some productions have used the concept of deafness as a way of portraying the key character. So could you say a little bit of how we do that and why that's important?
Yes. So it is as it is in the novel, it is in this musical. Quasimodo, the main character, the Hunchback of Notre Dame himself, is partially hard of hearing, partially deaf in this version of the story. He makes mention that he can still hear a little and read lips, but he, as it's described in the novel, has lost most of his hearing from the sheer volume of the bells that he's ringing constantly, many, many times a day.
So it's the bells that have been the cause of that.
Yes.
And as soon as I hear the word bells, it immediately makes me think of that opening number, which we're going to hear, the bells of Notre Dame, and then we'll talk a little bit about the set.
Sure.
So here we go with those bells ringing away, and don't turn the volume up in case you too have a hearing upset.
city awakes to the bells of Notre Dame.
The fisherman fishes,
the baker man bakes,
to the bells of Notre Dame.
To the big bells as loud as the thunder,
to the little bells soft as a song.
And some say the soul of the city is the toll of
the bells.
So, in your production, how many people are actually on stage singing at that moment?
Good segue, by the way. That was beautiful. I just love the music. There are 16 members in our cast. On top of that, we have an 18-person volunteer choir that just is like another character in the show. They sound magnificent. It's on top of that, a 14-piece orchestra. So it's this wall of massive, glorious sound that is going to smack the audience in the face, which is sort of the goal.
Good, good. Now, where is the orchestra located?
The orchestra is up in a loft above the cast up on stage left. They have their own little alcove up there.
So let's talk a little bit about the Hillbarn Theatre. I'm not familiar with it, but you can seat, what, almost 200 people in the audience?
Just about. It's 179, I believe, is the capacity. It's a very interesting and intimate space. I actually grew up performing there. So I know it very well. So coming back to direct something on the other side of the table wasn't as daunting as someone who's never worked in a space like this before is. It's very familiar to me. But it's amphitheater-style seating. So the floor of the building is the stage. The audience is sort of raised up around them. And it's almost a three-quarter thrust. The audience is almost in a full round.
And the acoustics?
Very interesting, because it is in a barn-like building, which is why it has that name, Hillbarn. The ceilings are very barn-like and almost vaguely cathedral-esque as well, so it kind of works for our show. But I am not a sound designer, but I'm sure it's a challenge to figure out the bouncing and the reverb and the, you know, I'm sure it's a challenge, but it sounds incredible. Audiences are going to, like I said, just the volume of sound, and I don't mean just volume in terms of how loud, I just mean the greatness of the sound of the orchestra, the choir, and this phenomenally talented cast.
Now, anyone who's been to the Cathedral Notre Dame in Paris will have a vision in their head, but for your production, you're sitting there in the auditorium, you're looking onto the stage, so what do they see as the set for Notre Dame?
So it was very important to me that the set looked like what we know of Notre Dame Cathedral. I wanted, as soon as the audience enters the theater, they are entering the working, living, breathing Cathedral of Notre Dame. We have excellent pre-show lighting and sound effects that are happening so that when people enter from their everyday lives, it immediately sets the heartbeat of the room. Everyone immediately gets on the same pulse so that when the story begins, we've already got them. They enter the cathedral. You'll see the famous rose window. You'll see a gorgeous balcony that resembles a bell tower. There are confessional booths on the sides of the stage, which is where we put the choir. Mm-hmm. It's a gorgeous set. The archways are beautiful, and the lighting design just makes everything pop in such a gorgeous way.
Now, as a director, you've obviously been on the show, on the set for some time, so how about talking a little bit about how you prepare for something like this?
Well, I started preparing for this show back in December, so it's been almost, I guess, 8 months by the time we close. I don't do math, so I might be wrong about that, but I've been with this material for 7-8 months now, and already I'm kind of nearing the end of my work on it. We open tomorrow, so tonight is our preview audience. So I'm already feeling nostalgic for the material. I'm already a little bit bittersweet about saying goodbye to it for now. I mean, I would hope to direct this again someday, but it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work, and for a while it's just me and my script and the album, which we're hearing a little bit of. Mm-hmm. But I have such a deep connection and deep love for this show now, especially having now been in the room with all the actors and worked on it. It's audiences are going to be very, very surprised at the message of this show and just how hard it hits home, especially for, you know, what we're experiencing today.
And this is a show which is very much about morality, about right and wrong. And I know Hugo had this in mind when he wrote the novel. And you said early on it's 60% Hugo, 40% Disney. So let's deal with that issue of right and wrong and morality. How does that affect your production?
Well, it's interesting. This is a classic story, and it deals with a lot of these big themes in life, like right and wrong, like us versus them mentalities, and people using fear as a tool for manipulation and to gather people behind a cause. Ultimately, I think the show is about humanity and acceptance, and there's the last line of the opening song is what makes a monster and what makes a man. Mm-hmm. And right there is your issue of right and wrong, and the audience is sort of left to decide that for themselves at the end of the play. The lead character, Quasimodo, does make a decision toward the end of the show. It's in the last few minutes. I don't want to give away the ending, but there, in the last few minutes of the show, there is a very clear moment where he decides what he believes is right and wrong. And I think as the audience, we're very much with him. I mean, you'll be the judge of that when you come see it. But I do believe the point of view is hopefully very clear. And, yeah.
In terms of Quasimodo, how is he dressed? What does he look like?
He's so polished and clean and very well taken care of. No, he's got almost a shorn haircut. The costume designer and myself decided that we wanted it to feel like his master, the archdeacon, who keeps him locked away in the tower, has had a very practical approach to taking care of him. So it's almost like being a sheep or you know, an animal that you take care of. He's shearing the hair off of him. He has, of course, a prosthetic that looks awesome and appropriately grotesque, a ratty tunic and a patched together cloak. He looks just right, is the answer.
and in terms of, I want to use the word deformity, how does he look physically?
Our actor Randy O'Hara plays Quasimodo. He has worked very hard since the beginning, and we've worked closely on how to best convey a physical deformity, not just with the prosthetic on his face, but the way he moves is very, very specific, and it's just such a big part of that character is mm-hmm. the way he moves, how he interacts with the space around him. You know, if he's been in this bell tower his whole life, he's got a very intimate relationship with every single archway, every single banister, every piece of this bell tower is his family.
Right, so he relates to his environment, and his body relates to the environment. You know, I ask it because I've seen Shakespearean productions of Richard III, which also mm-hmm. has a similar sense of how the body relates. And if we take the Archdeacon, who's playing the Archdeacon, and what sort of character is that?
His name is Gary Gerbino. Mm-hmm. The entire cast is terrific, but he's got one of the hardest jobs in the show, because playing a villain is so hard, and I use the word villain in air quotes, but in for the purposes of our story, he is the villain. But it's a heck of a job, because whenever you're playing a villain, you have to be able to find the love in this character, because I don't believe that anyone is born evil.
Mm-hmm.
In any classic villain story or villain character, there's always a reason. And it usually, if you boil it down, has to do with love. So in this version of the story, we learn about Frollo is his name, Frollo's backstory, which is not a part of the Disney animated film. So this is more of the novel. We learn about his relationship with his brother.
So did you have to bring that into the script, or was
it's
that?
It's written. So when Peter Parnell wrote the book for this musical, he made the choice to add more of the detail and backstory from the original novel. But it helps the audience in this version, in a stage musical, get a more detailed picture of who this guy is. So we learn about his relationship with his brother growing up in the cathedral, and how that relationship changed, and how it made Frollo develop into the sort of overbearing and very repressed person that he becomes at where our story picks up.
Okay, so we're going to hear a section now called The Rhythm of the Tambourine, and then we'll just get exactly where this is playing, how we can order tickets from you. But let's hear some music first.
Come on, come on.
Hurry, hurry, here's your chance. See the mystery and romance.
Come on, come on.
See the finest girl in France. Make an entrance to entrance. Dance, sly Esmeralda.
Wow.
Well, very rousing from kind of totally choral to almost, when I say, musical in the rhythm of the dance, that you can go from one phase to the other. I'm talking to Riley Costello. We're talking about The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Now, when does the show open?
Tonight is our preview performance. Tomorrow night, August 25th, we open for a three-week run. We close September 10th.
So you're playing on weekends?
Yes, it's Thursdays through Saturdays.
Thursday through Saturday, right. And again, the website, so people can contact you?
Excuse me, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. It's Thursday through Sunday.
Thursday through Sunday, we can take that back. Thank
yes,
you.
Sorry, my bad.
Okay. And how do they contact you?
They can get tickets at www.hillbarntheater.org. That's theater with an R-E. Although I think if you type in E-R, it still takes you to the website, but do R-E.
Okay, so there you've got two choices for you. Yeah. One will get you there, and the other will take you on a mystery tour.
Possibly somewhere
And just, again, remind people where the Hillbourne Theatre is.
We're located in Foster City at 1285 East Hillsdale Boulevard.
Okay, so if you want some rousing musical, if you want an insight on how Victor Hugo's great novel, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, got adapted and is now here in the Bay Area as a musical, check out the website.
HillbarnTheatre.org.
Okay, and then you will be in for some delightful, rousing whatever at The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Rousing whatever, I like it. Please come see us.
Okay, good. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me.
A monster! It's God's judgment on you. The wicked shall not go unpunished.
I should have known. I was a fool to think that you would look after him.
Look after him, me?
He has nobody else. Take him. If you can find it in your heart.
Cheyenne!
You're listening to Open Hour, and we've just been talking about the Hunchback of Notre Dame, very much a choral ensemble, but now we're going to talk about some wind music, the wind ensemble, and my guest is Ryan Bervelt. He's the executive director of the San Francisco Wind Ensemble. And just for people who maybe not altogether familiar, how many actual players make up an ensemble, or in your particular ensemble?
Our group, we've got roughly between 50 and 60 players, given the cycle that we're doing. But we usually top out about 60 plus.
And if we take the range of instruments, let's go from the extreme, from what to what?
Well, I'm partial, but the percussion section is a prime example. We have roughly 7 to 8 percussionists for every single cycle, and the parts really are extensive, and we have a full saxophone section, and we are modeled after the Frederick Fresnel model, which has one player to a part, and then flexible instrumentation is allowed to, you know, give some more color. Our ensemble type is all about, you know, it's kind of modeled after tone colors, and so it kind of rounds it all about, but the percussion section really is kind of a standout in our group.
And if we just take the saxophone, there's alto sax, bass sax. I mean, how is the range of the saxes going?
Alto, tenor, soprano, barry. Yeah, that's they have their own row in our group. Well, we have five rows, and we have a great saxophone section.
And with the San Francisco Wind Ensemble, one of the pieces you're playing is the Stravinsky Circus Polka. So we're going to hear that in a second. But just explain how this works for a wind ensemble.
This piece, Stravinsky was really important to the wind ensemble genre. And so we just kind of wanted to have something fun. And it's, just like a lot of Stravinsky music, it's got sort of twisted, circus. You know, this particular piece was actually commissioned from a Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus ballet. And the guy who commissioned Stravinsky wanted something for elephants, and Stravinsky said, "How old?" And the guy said, "I want young, and something for young elephants." And so it was actually really kind of interesting. So and there's actually like an inside joke built in, like the young elephant is actually referring to the guy who commissioned him. So
here we are for young elephants, Stravinsky, the Circus Polka. Yeah, well, that to me is a really interesting story. Yeah, the thought of an elephant dancing a polka, but also the use of that percussion where you get maybe the heavier elephants coming in at the background and giving it a thump.
Yeah.
So I think it's a very interesting place. Now, where is it you're performing? Where do we go to hear this?
We perform in San Mateo. We are called the San Francisco Wind Ensemble. Currently, our performance location is Aragon High School Theater, off of Avenida de las Pulgas in San Mateo.
And what are the acoustics like in that particular room?
This is an incredible theater, absolutely incredible space. Acoustics are fantastic, absolutely great. There's a balcony that people actually prefer to sit in, but there's really not a bad seat in the house.
Okay, now we do have a second piece which we're going to hear, and this is the Whitaker Equus. Could you take us into that a little bit?
Yeah, Equus actually means horse in Latin, and there are a lot of notes in this piece. He was asked by a friend of his. Eric Whitaker is he's one of the most successful composers of our time, but he got his roots in choral music. He's known a lot for choir, but he writes a lot for orchestra and for wind ensemble. And he wanted to create a modo perpetuo, a piece that's running and never stops. And he called it a dynamic minimalism, which essentially means he didn't want to be too repetitive and still be boring. He just didn't want to be boring. So,
and the idea of the horse, because we've heard about elephants, is there anything symbolic in the music that would relate to?
I see where you're going with that. I think that's just kind of a coincidence with this cycle. We have a sort of a, you know, nature animal theme going on. Maybe that's just an accidental thing, I think.
And just briefly, you're the executive director. Are you actually on stage with the?
Correct. I am a percussionist. I do play in the group. That's how I got my start, and I joined the board a couple years after that. But I do play in basically every cycle, every concert. There's some that I you know, choose to do more of my executive director role, and which is great. So, but I still like to participate with every single concert.
And this particular set of music, you've made the choice on these, is that right?
Yeah, we're sort of a, quote, shotgun group. So we don't have weekly rehearsals. We have a Friday night rehearsal, a Saturday day rehearsal, and then we perform Saturday night. So we do that about four times a year, and we've had that enables us to have guest conductors whenever we need, because they just come in for a weekend and they collaborate with us and then they leave. So we do have a full-time artistic director, our founder, Dr. Martin Zegelka. And so he is actually going to conduct us cycles 2 and 4 this year. But this first cycle is conducted by our good friend, board member, and actually host at Aragon High School, Troy Davis. He is our guest conductor this cycle.
And before we hear this, how many performances, how long will this be going on for?
This particular concert will probably be about, I'd say, like an hour and a half worth of music, maybe a little bit under that.
And is it a one-off, or is it repeated next weekend, or anything like that?
It's a one-off thing, yeah. We get together. It's sort of, we like to call it adult honor band sometimes.
Okay, So let's hear this dedication to a horse, at least, or given as the Latin phrase, Equus. Here we go. Well, that particular piece was played by the Utah State University Wind Orchestra, and I'm just wondering, when you were listening to it, how does that compare to your particular production?
That is a great question. Well, I mean, we are, adult, you know, we're a professional wind ensemble, and we have the parts, like, you know, fair amount in advance, but we are like a bunch of we're adults, and we get together a few times a year, but we have a really great camaraderie that, you know, all of us kind of would agree that we haven't been able to find with a lot of we're volunteer, but we've got a really great thing going on with our group, and we attract a lot of great players, and we have a lot of fun, and I think that's a big part of why people like coming back, is that, well, we have a certain amount of factors that just sort of allow a lot of freedom, and we play a lot of interesting and complex music.
Yeah, and I think when I was listening to it, I often think with a horse, you can go at a gallop, or you can go at a canter, or you can trot. And I think as the music was fading down, I was seeing the horse getting a little tired. You know, now the horse is not going to jump out over the sty and turn into what I call a racehorse.
Yeah.
So I think when music speaks to me, and I think music definitely speaks in a way that sometimes words don't, that your imagination is allowed to flow, you hear the sounds, you bring them in, and then you put a type of mental picture on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, as a performer yourself, when you're playing some of this type of music, what is going on inside your head?
Man, I really think that music actually gives us a timestamp on our human experience. And we look at, you know, as a performer, I look back on what I played and the literature that I played, and it actually kind of puts me back in that time. And it's kind of the same thing with recordings that we love and music, songs that we just loved. You know, you don't have to be a performer, but it gives you a piece of your life when you first discovered that song, and you can kind of keep rediscovering that moment every time you hear that. And so when I save a lot of the music that I've performed, and my fiance, she's got like two bins of flute music that she can't let go of, and I've got a lot of drum set books that I love to keep around, and a lot of the repertoire. And I think what it means is it gives you the opportunity to rediscover that part of your life when you discover that piece. And so that's kind of a lot of what goes for us, you know, is that, like, we get to play in this great group, and it allows us to kind of keep
music and memory. And
when
you maybe first played that particular piece, and then the different ways or the different interpretations you may have come up with over the years.
Yeah.
So how long have you been actually a performer, somebody who plays on a regular basis?
I have played music since I was 9. I started with piano, and I went to clarinet, and then I started playing drums in the 7th grade, and I didn't look back. I became a full-time percussionist, and I did everything I possibly could in high school, and then I went and I actually got a degree in it. And so I went to Cal State Long Beach down south and had an incredible percussion experience in that program, and grew up to continue my career in the music industry. And I'm not a full-time performer, but I have been able to find employment and build my skill set so that I'm able to keep performance and keep music as a central part of my career.
And then when we look at wind ensembles, I mean, historically, they must be rooted in the 19th century, at a quick guess.
It actually goes a little bit further back. Mozart actually started he started the tidal wave of actually getting, he appreciated wind colors, wind instrument colors, and used them as strings used to be. So that kind of started with Mozart, actually, and then it grew, it evolved, and after World War One, that's when, like, the sort of American
marching bands.
Yes, exactly. And so marching bands came inside a concert hall, and it further established wind ensemble music as it's still one of the the amount of new music that gets created for any particular genre, wind ensemble leads a lot of the categories, because it's really still a kind of a young medium.
And is the trombone still considered a serious musical instrument?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Our trombone section is awesome. I mean, our whole brass section is incredible. But yeah, I'm gonna tell them that you mentioned that.
Well, no, I laugh because my father, who was very much involved in music, when it came to marching bands, he would always say, put the trombones on the outside because they are the kid shifters. And the idea was that they would be extended out and make sure nobody got in the way. And what about the tuba? The tuba, to me, is another very deep instrument.
Oh, absolutely. We usually have two.
That's enough, isn't it?
I mean, I could go for a third, you know, mm-hmm. definitely. But they sit right in front. They usually are back center. In our group, we've got some great tubists.
Okay, so again, just for people who may have tuned in, let's repeat where you're performing. So give us the destination and give us a website so we can book tickets for you.
Sure. Our website is sfwindensemble.org. That's sfwindensemble.org. And you can find information about the concert, which is this coming Saturday, August 26th at 7:30 p.m. at the Aragon High School Theater in San Mateo.
And Ron, do you want to tell us the pieces that you know that you'll be playing?
Sure. We are doing the Stravinsky, what you just heard, the Circus Polka. We're also doing another Stravinsky piece called Symphonies of Wind Instruments, and that's sort of a chamber-esque piece for us. It's kind of a misnomer, the name. It's in one movement. It's not a full symphony, but it lasts about 9 minutes. And then we do the Eric Whittaker Equus, which you just heard. And then we end it with the Anton Alcaud Symphony No. 2.
So that's a good diverse range.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, this is the San Francisco Wind Ensemble. And you're playing where again?
Aragon High School Theater in San Mateo, California, this coming Saturday, August 26th.
And again, to contact you, the website?
sfwindensemble.org.
Okay, Ryan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you. You're listening to Open Hour. I'm Peter Robinson, standing in this week for David Latulli. And I'm going to be talking about a couple of different movies. One which is actually just finished running here in the Bay Area, but is now available on DVD, and it's called The Exception. And then the other two are the current issues on Netflix. And a couple of things about my own personal movie viewing. I'm somebody who really likes to be in the live theatre. I like that sense of people around me seeing how they too are feeling or responding to a particular moment in a movie. And I also like the fact that there are, if people obey the laws, no cell phones. So the great thing about being in the movie theatre is that you've gone out for a night at the movies, or an evening, or a day, or a morning, whenever you may be seeing it at the movies, as opposed to the disruption that sometimes can happen if you're watching at home. So the movie that, as I say, has just finished running but is now available on DVD is called The Exception. It stars Christopher Plummer, who's now aged 87, playing Wilhelm II, that is Wilhelm Kaiser. And it is set in the beginning of the Second World War. It's set in the year 1940. And at this point in his life, the Kaiser is actually living in exile in Holland. So Christopher Plummer is very much, I'm going to say, king of the castle. He's in a beautiful country house. He's actually kept away from the Nazi regime, which is now very much under the control of Hitler. And his wife, who is an ambitious lady, wants, if possible, to see the Kaiser returned in some sort of monarchical position back to Germany. So that's the background of the story, partly based once again on historic fact, but again tweaked to make the story interesting. Princess Hermione is played by Janet McTeer. She is the ambitious wife, and one of the key scenes in this whole film, the fact the movie turns around it, is a visit by Himmler. SS head Heinrich Himmler, played by Eddie Marsden, is sent to check out the Kaiser, see where his loyalties are going. And of course, there is a dinner party, and the whole issue of anti-Semitism is brought to the forefront. In real life, certainly the Kaiser held some anti-Semitic views. However extreme they were nothing like what Heinrich Himmler had in mind. And so this is a movie caught in a time warp. The year is 1940. It's before the real action is beginning to happen. And at the root of the story is a maid. She's Dutch. She is Jewish. And it certainly is something which is revealed pretty early on. She's also working for British intelligence. So now we have, as they say, the thick plot thickening even further. Things are beginning to turn. What role does the maid play? Who is transmitting messages back? And how does the story continue? Well, of course, there is that element of love and sex in time of war, because the maid, in fact, starts having an affair with one of the officers who is there to guard the Kaiser. So now we've got all sorts of different ingredients happening. A spy story, a thriller, a piece of history, and of course at the centre of all this is Christopher Plummer. People may remember his performance as King Lear, and this too is a development of that character. He has a great stage presence. He's able to command the castle. I always say he is king of the castle. And gradually the story takes on what I call much more of the thriller aspect than the history aspect. So if you're looking for something slightly different, something with a strong historic base to it, interesting backstory, magnificent acting, and an intriguing piece of what I call political espionage, my recommendation is check out this particular DVD, and the title of the DVD is called The Exception, and the key star in this particular movie is Christopher Plummer. So that's going to be on DVD. Now we're going to take a slight course different to some of the movie reviews this week, because the next two I'm introducing are available on Netflix. So we're talking about streaming, we're talking about taking things off the screen onto your own home device, your own television or wherever it is that you watch them. And these are two releases which are now made available in the month of August. They'll be running through September as well. And the first is The Founder. And I was a little mystified by the title until I realized this is the real McDonald's story. The great hamburgers that you eat or don't eat, depending on your taste or your palate. How did McDonald's come about? What is this background story to this? And I was surprised to find, for essentially a biopic of how Ray Kroc built his fortune by steamrolling Mac, or the great Big Mac, and how he outshone the two brothers, who in fact were very ethical food producers, could become such an intriguing and frankly capitalistic type story. So The Founder opens as a movie in the year 1954, and Ray, the key character, is racking up miles selling milkshake mixes. Oh yes, remember those milkshake mixes? No, so now we're back in the world of milkshake mixes, but that is not going as well as he hoped, and he stumbles on a bustling burger joint in San Bernardino, California. It's called McDonald's, and the crowds are smiling, the customers sail through, and the lines in this particular McDonald's are fast moving. So that's the essence of how it began. And playing the role of Mr. Keaton is just the right character to play the hustler. And from there, effectively what happens is that Ray begins to steal the techniques, and gradually the ethics of the original McDonald's people, the people who wanted to make tasty, nutritious, and above all, well-cooked hamburgers, suddenly find that they're dealing with somebody who's more interested in real estate. And that, of course, is the trick. Now, everyone can make comparisons to different people, but I don't know why Donald Trump kept on going through my mind as I watched the way this particular entrepreneur changed a simple hamburger joint into a mass empire, something that extended beyond the shores of America, outlets around the world. And in fact, you can throw up a map nowadays where they will show you where all the various McDonald's franchises are. But to me, it's an interesting financial story. It's an interesting franchise story in the sense that it's not the actual property, it's the estate that you own becomes the real trick of making money out of selling hamburgers. So again, for those looking for something slightly different, looking for a movie that gives you the background on what I consider to be a sociological phenomena that has definitely got the stamp made in America on it, the movie's title is The Founder. It's available on Netflix this month and through September, and it is the story of how really Ray Kroc, a one-time salesman selling milkshake mixers, suddenly turned somebody else's idea because he suddenly saw the word McDonald's from being a small McDonald hamburger joint in San Bernardino into the huge empire that is around today. Check it out, you'll be surprised. It's an interesting story. Now, as they say, for something totally different, but also very, very au courant, is a movie, again, available on Netflix called Icarus. And Icarus, you may be deceived by. It's not about the man who flew and saw his wings burnt by the sun, the Greek Icarus. This is the story of the Russian doping. I want to use the word crime because I think that is the best word to use for it. And what it does is begin to tell how, for a long time, when it came to international athletics, the Russians have been behind a major doping scandal that finally erupted in the World Games last year. So it's a documentary. It's a documentary based very much on reports which initiated in the New York Times. And, of course, it includes the story as a background story on the former cycling champion Lance Armstrong. But as you move into the documentary, all sorts of extra people get involved because you begin to see how people's conscience really, really make scientists decide, do they want to become part of this conspiracy? So Icarus is the story of what led up to Sochi, where the Russians ran away with numerous medals, and how, in fact, the whole question of doping became a part of the international athletic scene. But in the background of this is the influence of both the FBI and the CIA. They wanted to know how this process was happening, how people were being deceived, who was part of the deception, and just how far did it extend onto the international scene. And of course, at the centre of it is Putin himself. The money put into the Sochi Games, the actual authorization for the doping to continue, is what the Icarus story tells. And it raises what I consider to be serious geopolitical questions. For the sake of an athletic event, the Russians will go to this level, what does it mean when it comes to other, even more grave and serious international or diplomatic affairs? So here's something very different then. The title of the movie is Icarus. It is available on Netflix, and it is certainly a documentary that you want to watch from beginning to end, because the story takes us from the early days of what I call the cycling champion Lance Armstrong, through the testing process, through the physical process, how these various types of concoctions can improve you as an athlete, and then into the mass scale of how the Olympic Games suddenly took on a different shape or form. Highly recommended, both from a sporting point of view, from a historian's point of view, and I think more seriously today from a geopolitical point of view. So those are my three particular choices for this week. The first is The Exception, starring Christopher Plummer, a World War II movie about the Kaiser. The second is a really fun biopic about the founding of McDonald's. It's actually called The Founder. You'll find some interesting little bits of American history and capitalism thrown in there. And then finally, a documentary from the Netflix again. It is called Icarus, and it is the story behind the Olympic Games, how the Russians really changed the format of what it meant to be an athlete, and how indeed today we've now looked at the whole question of doping. Well, we started off our program early on with a tribute to Glen Campbell, and I was saying that if there's one song which always stays on my mind, it is Gentle on My Mind. And I think it's knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk. So we hope you're going to walk over here to us at KALW, enjoy what's happening around the Bay Area, and this is what Open Air brings to you. And we're going to go out with that tune in a second, but first I want to really acknowledge the help I've had today from our producer, Neil Swindles, and vital to it all, the person pushing the magic buttons and bringing the show to life, Ashley Ann Kriegerbaum, who is our engineer for today. Special thank you to you, Ashley. Good to have you here. And also to our guests. This is Peter Robinson standing in this week for David Latulli. You have been listening to Open Air.
It's knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk. That makes me tend to leave my sleeping bag rolled up and stashed behind your couch. And it's knowing I'm not shackled by forgotten words and bonds and the ink stains that are dried upon some line. That keeps you in the back roads by the rivers of my memory. It keeps you ever gentle on my mind. It's not clinging to the rocks and ivy planted on their columns now that bind me. Or something that somebody said because they thought we fit together walking. It's just knowing that the world will not be cursing or forgiving when I walk along some railroad track and find that you're moving on the back roads by the rivers of my memory, and for hours you're just gentle on my mind. Though the wheat fields and the clotheslines and the junkyards and the highways come between us, and some other woman's crying to her mother 'cause she turned and I was gone, I still might run in silence, tears of joy might stain my face, and a summer sun might burn me till I'm blind. But not to where I cannot see you walking on the back roads by the rivers flowing gentle on my mind. I dip my cup of soup back from a gurgling, crackling cauldron in some train yard. My beard a roughening coal pile and a dirty hat pulled low across my face. Through cupped hands round the tin can, I pretend to hold you to my breast and find that you're waiting from the back roads by the rivers of my memories, ever smiling, ever gentle on my mind.